Okay, thank you for attending the 2020 Sunstone Digital Symposium, session 136, titled The Plat of Zion and How It Changed. The audio from this session will be available for purchase at sunstone.org after the symposium. The video recording of this session will be available in the Whova app for approximately 3 months, beginning at the end of August 2020. Please type any questions that you might have for our presenter in the Whova app. They will be addressed during a question and answer session at the end. At Sunstone, we are making it a goal to build a community that allows many ways for people to express their faith. Our tagline is, "There is more than one way to Mormon." We invite you to help us build a community where all paths are given space to be better understood. Please support us in our mission by making a donation and subscribing at sunstone.org. About this presentation, Avery Truckleman said, "All structures are, in some ways, ideology made manifest." This session will explore the Plat of Zion, a city planning map Joseph Smith received by revelation, and explore the way this city planning map changed to reflect trends in LDS teachings. Our presenter, Graham Rattan, earned a BA in history and currently works in the culture and heritage sectors as a communications professional. He volunteers at a museum and at a fort in his local area in Alberta. I'm now going to give the floor to our presenter. And remember to be respectful in the questions and that they will be answered at the end. Graham Rattan.
Thank you very much, Benjamin. So this is a presentation regarding the center place, looking at the way that the Plat of Zion was initially revealed to Joseph Smith, and then how it changed over time while he was alive, and then how it changed afterwards as well, with Brigham Young and others continuing to use different versions of the Plat in their planned communities as they spread across the Rocky Mountain areas and Pacific Northwest down into Mexico and up into Canada, where I happen to be in Lethbridge right now. It's a really fascinating topic for me because the idea of effective city planning and the way that planned communities and cities impact the way that people live in those spaces and interact with each other, and even the way that they perceive the world are changed by the ways that things are laid out and how they are anticipated to have access to different public amenities and facilities, as well as the way that houses are laid out, and that will impact how people are interacting with their neighbors. So really interesting subject for me, and I'm excited to share some of my thoughts and a little bit of the research that I've done on this topic with all of you. So here we go. I will attempt to share my screen. So since 1820, the Mormon Church has focused primarily on building communities in many different ways. And early church history is absolutely full of individuals that came together to build houses and fences and barns, as well as temples, whole towns, cities, territories, and states. One that happens to be quite close to me is the Andreas Mikkelsen Farmstead near Sterling, Alberta, which was an LDS community that was populated by people coming up from the United States to build irrigation systems in exchange for land and for money for the church. The state animal of Utah is the honeybee, which stands for the productiveness and the even hive-like community mentality of early Mormon colonists and leaders. The physical communities varied from place to place and from area to area, but after 1833, they had a blueprint to work off for future communities, which was called the Plat of Zion, of course. And over 500 hamlets, villages, towns, and cities used the Plat of Zion as the base map for their community plan. All structures are in some ways ideology made manifest. This is a quote from Avery Truffleman on her podcast, Nice Try Utopia, which explores the different attempts at utopian community living that have been attempted in many different areas across the world. The beliefs of early Mormonism really shaped the design and the way that the Plat was realized during the life of Joseph Smith. But those beliefs are always changing in Mormonism. And that means that the plan changed over time. Its structure changed, its layout changed, even its execution changed. And there's a really strong argument to be made, I think, that those original principles that Joseph Smith used when he was designing the Plat have largely been discarded by the leadership of the LDS Church over the past 50 to 75 years. More recent building and development plans and proposals demonstrate a marked shift in theological and community priorities for the LDS Church. It's really rare that beliefs or teachings are clearly denounced by church leadership. It's pretty usual for the church leadership to simply stop talking about a topic and then just move on from it. In a 2001 interview with Time Magazine, then president of the LDS Church, Gordon Hinckley, answered a question about an old teaching that was at the time embarrassing to the church by saying, "I don't know that we teach it. I don't know that we emphasize it." I named this presentation the center place in reference to the temple or a church building being the intended physical center point for the Plat of Zion. But it's also a reference to the way that the current theology of the church has moved the center place of the religion as a whole over time. And that has in turn changed the way that the church then pursues community building and colonization strategies. The world that was imagined by Mormons of all sects over the decades has shifted quite subtly, but very substantially in ways that are really difficult to identify because of the centralized and correlated historical narrative that is produced and carefully curated by church leaders and by administration. So in 1830, Joseph Smith officially began Mormonism with a small group of believers in New York State. His followers were fervent advocates for the religion, and Smith began sending his followers on short missions to different regions of the Atlantic Northwest to expand his following. And by 1837, Smith had sent Heber Kimball and Orson Hyde on a mission to England. The instructions of the missionaries in all those regions were to convert people to Mormonism and get them to emigrate to Zion, or to the current headquarters of the church. And as many of us know, the definition of Zion has changed pretty substantially over time as well. Another example of the shifting center place. Those headquarters for the church moved from New York to Ohio to Illinois, all during the lifetime of Smith, and finally to Salt Lake City after his death for the LDS branch of the church. But for a brief period in 1839, Smith declared the new and permanent center place of the church to officially be in Jackson County, Missouri. In the Doctrine and Covenants, the term Zion appears about 200 times. And the context of these uses varies widely from things implying a community of believers generally across the entire world, a state of being within somebody's heart or soul, or the presence of faith within an individual, or having achieved salvation. But many of these are references to an actual location and an actual city, sometimes in the past, sometimes in the present, sometimes in the future. The concept of Zion and the plans to construct a physical community of that name really preoccupied Joseph Smith for many years. And as with previous utopian plans over the past centuries, Joseph Smith's utopia was meant to include a physical layout as well as a governance structure that would attempt to create and maintain a perfect society. The idea of utopias and putting down instructions on how they were to be built and governed had been around for centuries before Smith's time. And in 1602 CE, the Italian Dominican philosopher Tommaso Campanella was arrested for heresy and sedition. And that was because while he was in prison, he published his ideas in a book called La Città del Sole, or The City of the Sun, a book that presented a vision of a unified and a peaceful world that was governed by a theocratic government. In the closing sections of the book, Campanella predicted that the Spanish monarch of the time and in alliance with the papacy would construct a holy city, which would then act as a catalyst to usher in the ultimate theocratic world government. That idea that you will build something and Jesus will come, kind of like the Field of Dreams styles for religion, is called catalytic millennialism. It is going to be the catalyst that starts the millennium. At the same time that Campanella was writing, Johannes Valentinus André, a German theologian, was promoting a Protestant utopian movement, Rosicrucianism. The movement likely inspired several attempts at utopian Christian communities in Nuremberg around 1628, called the Unio Christiana, which was later attempted again in Stuttgart in the 1660s, so about 30 years later. And then another utopian fraternity called Antilia, which developed in the Baltic region during the 30 Years' War. So both of these individuals had really interesting ideas about how to create utopian societies with physical layouts. Andrei's work, Republicae Christianopolitanae Descriptio, or Description of the Republic of Christianopolis, lays out that city-state civic plan. Many of the ideas laid out in both of these works, and in many more works, can broadly be identified in Smith's ideal community as well. The site of Zion was disclosed by Smith over a period of months to his followers, and in January of 1831, he said that God would provide for the Mormons a, quote, land of promise. On June 6th, he gathered a group of followers to proselyte in the state of Missouri, and Smith promised them, while they were there, that God would reveal the location of a land of inheritance to them if they were successful. On July 20th, he wrote, "Hearken, O ye elders of my church, saith the Lord your God, who have assembled together yourselves together according to my commandments, in this land which is the land of Missouri, which is the land that I have appointed and consecrated for the gathering of the saints. Wherefore, this is the land of promise, and the place for the city of Zion. And thus saith the Lord your God, if you will receive wisdom, here is wisdom. Behold, the place which is now called Independence is the center place, and a spot for the temple is lying westward upon a lot which is not far from the courthouse." So in June of 1833, Joseph Smith and his counselors in the First Presidency prepared a plat, or city plan, for the city of Zion. A plat is a land use development plan for the layout of a city, and Frederick G. Williams drew the plat, which called for bishop storehouses and 24 temples in the center of the city, then surrounded by blocks that were divided into property for different residences. The plat named and included a brief explanation of each of the 24 temples, but Smith never had his followers build or use a temple before, so there's no way to know for sure what the intended uses of the buildings were going to be. So you can see at the center, you can see these three orange squares. Those were the bishop storehouses, and then each of these were intended to hold 12 temples, and then all of these lots around, surrounded by the green roads, were intended for residential use. And you can kind of see, it's a little fuzzy, that they are more or less supposed to alternate in the direction that they're facing. So the houses would presumably be situated kind of further, towards the edges. And then this would be the dividing line between the two properties. And so they're very, very deep lots, and fairly wide as well. So in terms of the temples, the first temple to be completed by Joseph Smith and his followers was in Kirtland, Ohio. And that temple was in operation 3 years after the original plat was drawn up by Williams, from 1836 to 1838. The Mormons used the Kirtland Temple, well, it was initially in operation from that time. The way that the Mormons used the Kirtland Temple is very different from the other temples that were later built by Smith and subsequently by Brigham Young in the LDS tradition. The 24 temples in Independence would likely have been centers for worship as well as for church and community administration, which is a little bit closer to the way that they used the Kirtland Temple initially. In terms of the bishop storehouses, which were to be located on one of the center squares, there's not a lot of detail about them. In the map, it's just one large block that is set aside for these buildings. They likely would have stored excess foods and excess materials produced on the lands of the residents and then redistributed those to the other members or to other building projects as needed, or stored it prior to sale to outside communities. But the interesting thing that these plans do, and it mirrors Christianopolis and the Città del Sole, is that they were built around the idea of having religious buildings as the physical center of the community, as well as the cultural and obviously religious centers of the community. And they were really the only community edifices. They were the only public buildings that were intended for this plan. In small and rural Mormon communities that I'm familiar with in Southern Alberta, this is still largely the way that things are set up today, where the church functions are often the primary social and community events that occur. in villages close to where I'm, like Hillspring and Glenwood, or in towns like Cardston and McGrath, or in Raymond even, the municipal government does relatively little in the way of economic social development support. And instead, they fulfill those functions, or they leave the fulfillment of those functions to religious institutions in either formal or informal public-private partnerships. So looking at the variety of American grids, because obviously designing cities in a grid was not unique to Joseph Smith, very common North American phenomenon. The original plat that was drawn up in June 1833 had city blocks that were a square mile long on each side. And this was more than 10 times the amount of property that the church controlled in the designated area near Independence, Missouri, even after 2 years of fastidiously purchasing land there. So it was a very ambitious plan. One of the most striking features of the plat was that its blocks were significantly larger than any other city of the time. They were larger than the city blocks in New York or Philadelphia, and they also featured huge street allowances for all roadways and a set of central blocks for religious buildings and large property lots for all the residential spaces. The large size of the lots was an attempt to encourage residents to grow crops, to grow orchards, or to have livestock on their property. Each city block was to measure 10 acres, with skinny long lots of a quarter acre each. Smith wanted all the houses in the city to be built out of brick or stone. Houses were all to be set back from the road by 25 feet. The land in front and behind the house was to be used for gardens and orchards. No stables were to be allowed in town, and no lot was to have more than one house on it. Smith intended for the plat to house between 15 and 20,000 residents. And then once it was filled up, the plan was to just build another identical grid right next door and continue to expand out. The plan included no parkland, no community spaces or buildings, except for those that had a religious function. And it also did not lay out where any large-scale agricultural spaces would be, except to say that they should be situated on whichever opposing side of the city would suit them best. So either having a set of agricultural lands on the north and south or on the east and west, depending on local circumstances. Sam Greenspan, one of the podcasters with 99% Invisible, wrote about the design of the Plat of Zion. This imagined city would offer the best parts of the city, infrastructure, education, and community, but without vice and crime. Joseph Smith thought that this could be achieved by giving residents lots of space, and it would essentially be a rural city. After only 2 months of the design of this first plat that was recorded by Frederick G. Williams, Smith and his counselors created another revised plat. This increased the land required to 1.5 miles square, and this was also never built. But you can see it's very similar in design to the first one, where you have alternating lots facing north, south, and east, west. The center two blocks are taken up by the 12 temples. Now there's no space on there for the bishop's storehouses, though. So an interesting change there. So things progressed rather quickly in Missouri after that point. And by July 1833, a mob had destroyed a church-operated printing press. And they were driven out of Jackson County later in 1833. After several years of tensions increasing, things finally culminated in the Mormon War of 1838. So that was actually several years of tensions increasing. Culminated in the creation of Zion's Camp, a militia assembled by Joseph Smith to retake the property in Missouri and seek revenge. The militia were ultimately unsuccessful in reclaiming the lands, and Governor Lilburn Boggs issued a Missouri Executive Order 44, which then directed that the Mormons must be treated as enemies and must be exterminated or driven from the state if necessary for the public peace. Their outrages are beyond all description, is what the executive order reads. So Smith and his followers were forced to abandon their plans to build Zion in Missouri as originally directed by Revelation. Currently, the land that was originally purchased by the church is in the possession of three groups of that original religious movement. The Community of Christ owns most of the 63.27 acres that were ultimately purchased by Edward Partridge. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints owns the next largest portion, and the smaller of the three, including the spot that was actually dedicated for a temple, is owned by the Church of Christ, once known as the Church of Christ Temple Lot, just to give a little bit of context there. This church was founded by Granville Hedrick, a Mormon who stayed when Brigham Young took his group of saints to the Salt Lake Valley after leaving Nauvoo. Hedrick and his followers returned to Independence, Missouri in 1867. I don't think I can overstate how important this little section of land, these little chunks of land are to Mormon theology and LDS theology, because this has been revealed to be the central spot of a new world government that must be built prior to the second coming of Jesus Christ. And I would suppose that all true believing Mormons are essentially waiting for a prophet to call on everyone to move back to Jackson County, Missouri, and actually build up the physical kingdom of Zion there. This is one of the most important sites to the imagined future or the revealed future of the Mormon worldview. One of the main parts about the governance of Zion was intended to be the law of consecration. And this law was first explored by Smith in 1831. And in effect, members of the church were asked to deed their property to the bishop of the church. And the bishop would then grant back an inheritance or a stewardship to the members. Individuals and families would care for and work the property and would be expected to turn over surplus resources from their property to the bishop at the end of the year. And this could be understood as a form of theocratic communism, which is fascinating to me. In DNC 42, 30 through 34, it reads, "Behold, thou will remember the poor and consecrate of thy properties for their support that which thou hast to impart unto them, with a covenant and a deed which cannot be broken. And inasmuch as ye impart of your substance unto the poor, ye will do it unto me, and they shall be laid before the bishop of my church. And they are laid before the bishop of my church, and after that he has received these testimonies concerning the consecration of the properties of my church, they cannot be taken from the church. And every man will be made accountable unto me, a steward of his own property, or that which he has received by consecration, as much as is sufficient for himself and his family. And again, if there be properties in the hands of the church, or any individuals of it more than is necessary for their support after this first consecration, which is a residue to be consecrated unto the bishop, it shall be kept to administer to those who have not from time to time, that every man who has need may be amply supplied and receive according to his wants. Therefore, the residue shall be kept in my storehouse to administer to the poor and needy, as he shall be appointed by the high council of the church and the bishop of his council." So to restate that really simply, from everyone, from each according to his ability to each according to his needs. To me, this sounds like a little bit like voluntary serfdom or church-led communism instead of state-run, although in a theocratic government, those kind of mesh and there's not a lot of distinction there. And under this law, it's clear that the church itself was intended to own the whole city and people would just live there. So for gathering to Zion, I want to talk a little bit about that gathering aspect of early Mormon missions. Today, the church discourages people from moving to Utah, and that would be the LDS church, for the purpose of, quote, coming to Zion. Church leaders officially redefined Zion as anywhere a unit of the church is organized, and currently the LDS church encourages members to stay in their own communities and build up their communities there. However, for over a century, the primary definition of Zion was the headquarters of the church, and missionaries strongly encouraged converts and members to move there, to Zion. The idea was to gather as many believers into one place as possible to begin building and expanding a physical kingdom from that center place. And that concept is called catalytic millennialism. By building a certain community or structure in the right way, it will actually trigger the second coming of Jesus Christ. Joseph Smith taught that the second coming of Jesus was going to happen within or just after his own lifetime. And he taught his followers that if they established Zion, Jesus would come and establish his theocratic government in their city. So it was imperative to physically gather as many faithful members of the church to that location as possible. In terms of building homes, as people sold or left their homes in Europe, Canada, the US, different areas, they would move to where the church was located at the time. And this meant that when they arrived, they needed lodging. And often they needed help purchasing land and building homes. So starting in 1831, Joseph Smith began another system of theocratic communism to try to control as much of the land and assets as possible and to provide land and housing for new arrivals to his communities. And this system is broadly known as the law of consecration. As I mentioned before, the system required that members actually deed their property to the church and they would be allowed to occupy their lands as a stewardship or inheritance. Members were expected to garden and farm on their lands so that they were sustained by their own labors. And they were required to turn over the excess generated on their lands to the church. Shortly after announcing this system, Smith made living the law of consecration mandatory for members of the church. And when Mormons were driven out of Missouri, Smith blamed their expulsion from the state in part on the members not fully committing to living the law of consecration. So an interesting way of explaining that expulsion. After Smith's death, Brigham Young emerged as the leader of the main body of the religion after a succession crisis. Young led a large sect of the Mormon colonists into the Rocky Mountains, and they settled in the Salt Lake Valley. And he quickly began building the city of Salt Lake on the Plat of Zion, beginning with surveying the valley, starting from a center block that was to be dedicated to the temple and other buildings for religious ceremonies and worship services. So very similar to the original intention in terms of centering everything around that. As more Mormons emigrated to Utah from Eastern Canada and the US, as well as from Europe, Young sent out colonies to firmly establish a Mormon presence up and down the Rocky Mountains. Today, this is known as the Mormon Belt or the Mormon Corridor or the Jello Belt. And it extends from northwestern Mexico into southwestern Canada. And in 1855, Young began requiring the members of the church to deed their property to the church as part of the law of consecration. And in 1874, he began a new form of the law of consecration called the United Order of Enoch. And that had some significant differences from the original way that the system operated in Ohio and in Missouri. So with this new system, rather than consider the individual property lots as stewardships, the means of production were the stewardships. All of the members of the community would receive shares of the net income of the means of production as a type of cooperative. Some of these means of productions included things like hat factories, tailor shops, soap factories, boot and shoe factories, machine shops, woodworking shops, sawmills, dairies, all kinds of things. The distribution of the shares wasn't even, and it often depended on the amount of land that individuals initially deeded to the church through the cooperative. The cooperative style of theocratic communism was used in at least 200 Mormon communities that surrounded Salt Lake, including St. George and Bunkerville, Nevada. These cooperative systems were also fairly short-lived. Most of them were defunct by the time of Young's death in 1877. You can find lots of interesting stories about how the United Order of Enoch worked in Leonard Arrington's absolutely phenomenal book, An Economic History of the Latter-day Saints, 1830 to 1900. One of the fascinating stories is of the community of Orderville. Arrington says that Orderville had been founded in an atmosphere of dire poverty, and the common action which took place in the order made it possible for members to eat and dress better than they had for years, better, in fact, than many residents in surrounding settlements where the United Order had not functioned successfully. When the Utah Southern Railroad was completed in Milford, Utah, however, the rich silver mines at Silver Reef, which were not far from Orderville, were exploited to the full. And within 5 years, more than $10 million worth of silver was extracted. Orderville's neighboring community, profiting from this boom, suddenly found themselves able to buy imported clothing and other store commodities. And the saints at Orderville became old-fashioned. Adolescents began to envy the young people in those other communities. A young man in Orderville wanted a new set of pants, but the rules of the community said that all clothing must come from the same bolt of cloth, as all were to be equal and there was to be no inequality among them. His pants had no holes, and his request for a new pair was denied. The primary business of the community's cooperative was raising and shearing wool from sheep, and when the lamb's tails were docked that year, the young man surreptitiously gathered them and sheared off the wool, which he stored in sacks. When he was assigned to take the load of wool to Nephi, he secretly took the lamb's tail wool with his load and exchanged it for a pair of store pants. On his return, he wore his new pants to the next dance. His entrance caused a sensation. The story is that one young lady rushed to him, embraced him, and kissed him. The president of the new order demanded an explanation, and when it was truthfully given by the young man, he said, "According to your own story, these pants belong to the order. You are requested to appear before the board of management tomorrow evening at 8:30 and to bring the store pants with you." At the meeting, the young brother was commended for his enterprise, but was reminded that all pants must be made from the same bolt of cloth. However, to prove its goodwill, the board of management agreed to have the store pants unseamed and then used as a pattern for all pants made in the future. And further, the young man in question would get the first pair of those new pants. As these cooperatives were dissolved, the memories of those who had lived in them became increasingly nostalgic, writes Arrington. With the disintegration of their collective institutions, after 10 years of cooperative living, the older members began to reflect on the advantages of their previously enjoyed communal experience over the encroaching spirit of competitive individualism. The chafing under the restrictive regulation, the disagreements, the yearning for privacy were all forgotten, and their memories were sweet. Almost every published reminiscence of life under the order mentions it as the closest approximation to a well-ordered and supremely happy Christian life that was possible of achievement in human society, close quote. The Law of Consecration and the United Order of Enoch were intended as attempts to eradicate poverty and promote a sense of unity within Mormon communities. The systems bear many similarities to Marxist communism. In one Mormon scripture from Moses 7:18, there is a highlight of that similarity. Quote, "The Lord called his people Zion because they were of one heart and one mind and dwelt in righteousness, and there was no poor among them." While I won't go into all the similarities between the systems, it is an interesting and a very fruitful comparison, and others have studied it. I would really encourage everybody to go check out their work if you're interested in it. Today, the Law of Consecration is still something that all endowed members of the LDS Church explicitly take an oath to obey as part of the endowment ceremony in LDS temples, but it's not enforced among the general population of members. Instead, all members in good standing are expected to pay the church 10% of their annual income through tithing. However, many prophets and leaders of the LDS Church have predicted that the Law of Consecration, as preached by Smith, will one day be reinstituted either before or during the millennial reign of Christ on the earth. Even though Mormons were forced to leave the center place of their Zion in Independence, Missouri, Joseph Smith intended for this plat to be used as a land use map and extend Zion in a grid of architectural and residential spaces until it finally filled the whole earth. On the north and south are to be laid off the farms for agriculturists, a sufficient quantity of land to supply the whole plot. If it cannot be laid off without going too great a distance from the city, there must also be laid off east and west where this square is, thus laid off and supplied. Lay off another in the same way, and so fill up the world in these last days, and let every man live in the city, for this is the city of Zion. And that's located on the reverse side of this plat. 11 years after the Mormons were driven from Missouri, Joseph Smith began to campaign to become president of the United States. One of the tools that he used to organize his campaign was a secret group of powerful individuals that he created called the Council of 50. The records and minutes of this organization have only been made public within the last 5 or 6 years as part of the Joseph Smith Papers Project. John Lee, who was the official scribe of the council, describes it as the municipal department of the kingdom of God set upon the earth from which all law emanates for the rule, government, and control of all nations, kingdoms, and tongues and people under the whole heavens. The council anointed Joseph Smith as the prophet, priest, and king of the earth. Continuing the goal of generating the correct circumstances for the millennium and seeking to position the church and its leaders for that auspicious time. Shortly after Smith's anointing, he was arrested for ordering the destruction of a printing press that had published information about his practice of polygamy and polyandry with several dozen women, some as young as 14. After he was arrested, a mob swarmed the jail where he and a few other leaders of the church were being held, and they killed both Joseph and his brother Hiram there. The Council of 50 shortly afterwards anointed Brigham Young its leader and as king and president of the Kingdom of God, similar to how they had Joseph Smith. Under Young, the secret council then assisted the Mormon exodus from Nauvoo, Illinois, and the eventual migration across the Rocky Mountains. Young relied on the results of scouting missions by members of the council in choosing the Great Basin as a destination for their exodus from Nauvoo over several alternate possibilities, including sites in Texas, California, Oregon, and on Vancouver Island, British Columbia, in Canada. which is actually where I grew up, claim to fame. The rapid colonization of a massive area of land by Mormon settlers was used as the basis by Brigham Young for founding a provisional state of Deseret, which was proposed to the U.S. Congress and was intended to include significant portions, as you can see here, of Arizona, California, Colorado, Idaho, Nevada, New Mexico, Oregon, Utah, and Wyoming. A very ambitious land claim. Well done. Ultimately, it was not approved by Congress in the form originally proposed, but they did create a Utah territory and grant it territorial status in 1850, and it did include portions of present-day Utah, Colorado, Nevada, Wyoming. Since its founding in 1820, the Mormon Church had sought to bring converts from their homes in North America and Europe to the cities and regions where Mormonism was building strength at the time, the mandate to gather. And that was in New York, Missouri, Illinois, and then finally in Utah. The church established a fund to aid converts' immigration to Utah called the Perpetual Immigration Fund. By 1882, the United States Congress passed the Edmunds Anti-Polygamy Act, which declared polygamy to be a felony, and all of the top leaders of the church were then practicing polygamists with at least two wives. In his annual address to Congress in 1885, President Grover Cleveland emotionally discussed the issue of polygamy in Utah. The strength, the perpetuity, and the destiny of the nation rest upon our homes, established by the law of God, guarded by parental care, regulated by parental authority, and sanctified by parental love. These are not the homes of polygamy. There should be no relaxation in the firm but just execution of the law now in operation, and I should be glad to approve such further discreet legislation as will rid the country of this blot upon its fair fame, since the people upholding polygamy in our territories are reinforced by immigration from other lands. I recommend that a law be passed to prevent the importation of Mormons into the country. Polygamous church leaders at all levels went into hiding for many years, and some were caught by federal marshals and sent to prison. Although the church challenged the legality of the laws that had outlawed their practices, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld the constitutionality of those laws in 1890. Charles Oricar was one of the polygamous leaders in Utah. He was a state president at the time in the 1880s, and he was caught by federal marshals and arrested for polygamy in Utah on July 26, 1886. The Deseret News on that same day issued a report about the arrest, which provided enough details for those interested to either say their goodbyes to Card or to perhaps help engineer an escape from the federal marshals. It read, President C.O. Card was arrested this morning about 9:30 by Deputy Marshal Gar. His house was searched and several members of his family subpoenaed. Will leave for Ogden on the 2 o'clock train. Fairly detailed. Card was able to slip away from the marshals on the train to Ogden, and he was helped by the members of the congregation that he led at the time to escape on a horse. He then hid in a series of houses in various communities for 2 months. In September 1886, he was sent to Canada to find a site for a Mormon colony across the U.S. border. LDS leaders had previously sent representatives on a similar mission to establish settlements across the border in Mexico. A big impetus for these missions was likely finding a way for church leaders to evade federal laws prohibiting polygamy in the United States. Card and his companion traveled through the town of Kamloops in British Columbia to Cranbrook, eventually taking a train to Calgary in Alberta. From Calgary, they turned south towards the U.S. border again, and they reached Standoff, Alberta, on October 22nd, 1886. Card recorded in his journal that he thought that the area near the Belly River or the St. Mary River would be a good place to establish a colony and, quote, mission to the Lamanites. Card returned to Salt Lake City in secret and met with church leaders who were still in hiding from the federal marshals. While Card was in Utah, the U.S. Congress passed the Edmunds-Tucker Act and the U.S. marshals stepped up their efforts to arrest polygamous Mormon leaders. 4 years after passing that act, Congress passed the Edmunds-Tucker Act of 1886, and the effect of the 1886 Act was to effectively disincorporate Mormonism as a religious institution, or the LDS Church as a religious institution, due to noncompliance with the anti-polygamy legislation. The act authorized federal government to confiscate all LDS Church properties valued at over $50,000, and it ended the Perpetual Immigration Fund. Card gathered a small group of colonizers and left for the border before he could be again found and arrested by the U.S. Marshals. Card and a even smaller group of leaders came ahead of the main body of colonists to choose the specific location of their new home, and they arrived there in 1887. They considered lands near Standoff, Alberta, sites on a couple of nearby ranches up and down the St. Mary River, and finally they decided on the current site of Cardston, which is just a little bit away from the actual conjunction of the St. Mary and, anyways, right near the St. Mary River and Lee Creek. By June 3rd, the rest of the colonists had arrived with their supplies, and Card began to survey the new community and lay it out in the forms that were prescribed by the Plat of Zion. Card, as with many other communities, made amendments to the plat for his community. His blocks were the same size as those that Smith originally designed, but he surveyed only a grid of 12 blocks, so much smaller than intended for the full plat. The roads were similar widths, but a little smaller. They were only 99 feet wide, and Smith's original design called for 132 feet wide. When he resurveyed the town site again in 1894, he expanded the original size of the community to a square mile, which was the size of the first version of the Plat of Zion, but still half a mile square shorter than the second plat designed by Smith. In 1898, the leaders of the Mormon Church entered into a contract with Sir Elliot Galt and Charles McGrath to construct an irrigation system in southern Alberta. The contract required the church to provide skilled laborers to build 50 miles of irrigation canals from Kimball to Sterling. They were also required to populate two settlements along the planned irrigation line with at least 250 settlers each, and these two communities will become the towns of Sterling and McGrath. Voluntary immigration of Mormon colonists was quite slow despite the propaganda that was put out by the church in Utah. And to fill the gaps in their obligations, they began calling men on missions to build the irrigation canal and called others on missions to settle their families in southern Alberta to meet their contractual obligations. When Sterling, which is a small village in southern Alberta, was first settled in May 1898, it was 1 square mile in size. Card surveyed it and divided the land into 10 blocks, or excuse me, into blocks of 10 acres, each divided into 8 lots of 2.5 acres each, so 1/4 of a lot. These lots were several times the size that Smith had originally designed for the Plat of Zion, and the size of the residential lots was intended by Card to accommodate colonists building a house and a barn and animal shelters and to grow a large garden and orchard. Also different from the original plat, in which animal barns and stables were not allowed on residential lots. The center lot of the original plat was supposed to contain many temples, but the concept was shrunk by Young to be only one temple in the center block, and the Sterling model shrank it even further to be one portion of a center block for a religious building, which is just a meeting house. So the question that really sparked me digging into this is, why doesn't the church build with the plat today? In the 1800s, the different branches of the Mormon Church established hundreds of colonies on indigenous land in what is today Canada, the US, and Mexico. Most of these colonies were built using the Plat of Zion as a base map, but with modifications. But since then, most of the colonization or construction efforts of the LDS Church have focused on building churches and building temples and building large multi-use buildings in major cities across the world, including a few private colleges and universities. But the days of building towns and cities from scratch seem to have been left in the past for the most part. But the financial and land holdings of the LDS Church have continued to increase over the decades. The LDS Church is actually currently the largest private landowner in the entire state of Florida. Their for-profit Deseret Ranches and its subsidiary companies own 672,834 acres, which is 2% of the state's entire land mass currently. The church has plans approved by Osceola County for future development of a 19,000-acre section of the Deseret Ranches, which is located 10 miles from the Orlando International Airport. The planned community that would go on this 19,000-acre section would house 500,000 individuals. The development isn't planned to be completed until 2080, There's speculation among environmentalists and the legal community in Florida, based off plans that were released in the church's long-term lawsuit about water rights on its land, that the church is planning on using the waters on their Florida property to begin bottling and selling that natural resource as well. Other large-scale development that the church has conducted include a 32-story mixed-use high-end residential tower in the Museum District of Philadelphia called the Alexander. That building is estimated to have cost as much as $120 million to complete. It includes 258 high-end apartments, 13 townhouses, and retail space, a community club room, a rooftop deck, and a large courtyard. In a 2018 LDS Daily article about the Alexander's development, quote, since the church's temple, meeting house, and Alexander apartments project in Philadelphia, more developers are investing in an area that was once considered blighted by city planners. It sent a signal in that area that A, people want to live there, B, there's activity going on, said Paul Levy, president of the Center City District. And I think that will have a very positive effect over the next 3 to 4 years, close quote. In Joseph Smith's day, he focused on the Mormon Church's activities in the public sphere on providing housing and basic needs to members and citizens through a form of theocratic government in his version of Zion. In Brigham Young's day, it focused more on controlling and communizing the means of production. Both of these systems required the surrender of private property to the church and rendering excess goods created by an individual's household to the church. Today, the corporation of the LDS Church is focused on financial investments, land and business management, and capitalist ventures that primarily benefit business owners and investors. According to information gathered and released by independent website Mormon Leaks, the LDS Church has connections or owns U.S. stock market holdings valued at least $32 billion. We've since seen that that's quite a bit more. The shift from creating self-sustaining communities to supporting business owners and investors can be most clearly seen in the massive investments the church made in downtown Salt Lake City beginning in 2003. The LDS Church bought, demolished, and redeveloped an entire city block adjacent to the church's Temple Square and church administration buildings into a high-end shopping center in an effort to increase economic activity in downtown Salt Lake. The process started in 2006 and the City Creek Center opened in 2012. The LDS Church spent an estimated $1.5 billion on the development of the City Creek Center, part of a $5 billion plan to revitalize the downtown Salt Lake City area. In comparison, the total value of all humanitarian aid worldwide done by the LDS Church between 1985 and 2011 totals $1.4 billion. It's a clear shift of priorities for the religious corporation in community building, from ensuring basic needs for all residents to encouraging capitalist economic success. However, the Plat of Zion and some of the principles behind it have been adopted by one oil industry millionaire who has begun buying land in preparation to build a new series of cities based on the concepts in the Plat of Zion. In 2016, a librarian named Nicole Antal discovered that millionaire David Hall was buying significant tracts of land in rural Vermont near the town of Sharon, which was the birthplace of Joseph Smith, with the intention of building a model community called New Vistas. The community is intended to house about 20,000 people and will test using technology to combine population density with self-sufficiency. New Vistas, said Hall, is my own modern interpretation of Joseph Smith's community documents. The plat describes a very low footprint, 20,000 people on only 3 square miles. Everything else was supposed to be wilderness. The New Vistas Foundation website says that the planned community will push for increased density for their version of urban development and has plans for standard 3-story buildings to increase scalability as well as economies of scale so that the communities can be replicated and spread throughout the world, as with Smith's original vision. Each completed one of these communities would have about 15 to 20,000 people, also similar to Smith's original vision. The organizational structure is certainly a corporate plan and leans much closer to the development strategy of the LDS Church in the 2000s than the development strategy of LDS Church leaders in either the 1800s or the early 1900s. New Vistas indicates that the community would be, quote, organized according to a private capitalistic economic structure. The community is not a political entity, but a productive enterprise like a company town, close quote. Hall wants to maintain control over land use, transportation, and community environment, which are usually matters of government concern, which is also very similar to Smith's determination to literally own the deeds to all property within his proposed city.
I need to warn you, a 5-minute warning.
Thank you. That's actually great timing. The image on the right is rendering of the proposed interior of one of the blocks, and you can see the proposed housing development on the outside. While Hall was buying chunks of land for his New Vista project in Sharon, he was also buying some for another development in Provo, Utah. In the years since the discovery of Hall's New Vista plans in Virginia and Utah, local opposition to those communities has been somewhat fierce. One of the quotes indicates that, or says, to have someone with money and power enter our area and gradually buy up homes, offering distorted purchase power to grab residences is troubling. It shakes the peace and violates the sense of community for mutual care for one another. I think that this is an interesting window into the way that the individuals that were living in Independence, Missouri may have felt when Smith and his followers were doing the same thing in Independence in the 1830s. A few people against Hall's plan said that it ran against Smith's original vision for the community. And I would argue that it, one of the big differences in what it does is it exchanges theocratic communism for technocratic corporatism and capitalist intentions. The biggest difference between the two plans seems to be focused on the sectioned off lots within Hall's vision of small apartments and shared community garden spaces in the center of the blocks. The early plat of Zion consisted of large family yards and agricultural spaces. In contrast, Hall's plan calls for tiny urban apartments of 200 square feet. In 2018, Hall announced that he was abandoning his plans, I believe in Sharon is where this quote came from, saying, "I'm tired of the drama." Utopias have been part of the mythology of humankind for millennia. Crafting a perfect home, a perfect community, and a perfect nation has been the dream of authors and dictators and authoritarians and theologians and prophets and citizens. When Joseph Smith recorded the Plat of Zion, it was not the first or the last entry in the field of utopian city plans. In the podcast Nice Try with host Avery Truffleman, which I highly recommend, she re-examines some of history's most fascinating attempts to build perfect communities. And while she doesn't touch on the Plat of Zion or the United Order under either Joseph Smith or Brigham Young, she notes that utopian plans do have something in common. Quote, "Somewhere along the line, things didn't go according to plan." As she points out in the closing words of each episode, utopias do not exist. Smith's efforts at creating a string of utopian communities and communes across the eastern United States, his changing vision of how that would be possible, his repeated failures or endings, the literally hundreds of attempts that Brigham Young made to create utopias, the current efforts of the corporate LDS church to use economic and market forces to beautify and enhance rich neighborhoods and metro areas, the efforts of Mormon millionaires to marry corporate paternalism with Smith's original city layouts and beliefs, all of them have failed to produce the kind of utopian society that will usher in the millennial reign of Jesus. Their efforts at catalytic millennialism have not succeeded. And along the way, the ideological and the theological center place has shifted dramatically. From 24 temples to one, from self-sufficiency and equitable distribution of resources to enriching the already rich, from expanding colonies internationally to an intensely nationalistic America First approach to development and investment. The center is not what it once was. The effects of Smith's initial vision for his utopian worldwide civilization is now baked into small communities in southern Alberta, in Utah, and even Mexico. Wide roads, huge grids, center points focusing the community on old church buildings. But these communities are changing, albeit slowly. Old churches are now civic centers, like this one in Cardston. New subdivisions that are laid out in these communities do not extend in square 10-acre blocks and cap some low traffic roads in an attempt to create safer residential spaces for pedestrians. there are no additional city grids being laid out side to side to fill up the world in most of these communities as originally intended. Lots are subdivided smaller and smaller to increase density and affordability. Few people choose to plant an orchard in their massive backyard, but some do. While knowledge of the plat may be somewhat uncommon now, its structure continues to shape the way that people experience those communities, and it continues to attract believers to live there. Thank you very much for your time. Any questions?
Awesome. Thank you so much for that presentation. We do only have about 3 minutes left, so we're going to have to be quick about these. I've got a question here. Do you think that communal utopian type societies will become more popular as normal society becomes more chaotic? It seems that trends are moving towards smaller communities and autonomous zones. What do you have to say about that?
I don't think so, given the trend away from rural living and towards urbanization. I think that once things settle down with COVID over the next couple of years and given a little bit more stability with the political situation, I think we'll continue to see the trend of people moving from rural areas to urban areas.
Right, but of course I'm picturing some of those urban developments are going to be intentional communities of some kind, which could be interesting to see how that comes out. Here's another one. Do you think that communal utopian type societies, recognizing like the Plat of Zion, which is intended to affect the way people in the city lived their faith and affect them spiritually, how do you see things like the layout of Salt Lake City or some of these other attempts, how do you believe that they affect residents today?
I think living in one of the small towns that was based around these plats, the way that you have to refer to your location based on where the center point of the city is a constant reminder of where, like, you are always oriented towards that center point. I think that is an interesting challenge in a period where we're seeing a rise in a-religious individuals, the rise of the nuns, where we are still orienting ourselves in these communities around these religious buildings. So I think that it's a really intentional way to get people to always have in the back of their minds, the center of my community, the center was always built around religion. It's definitely kind of hanging over you all the time, whether in a positive light or a negative light, depending on your perspective on the religious institution that controls those spaces. It's a difficult question to answer because it gets at so much of the lived experience of those communities. The other thing that really impacts it is in a lot of these communities, the center point was specifically chosen to be a higher point. And so you're also seeing these religious buildings dominating the landscape where you're always seeing them and you're always able to refer back to them. So there's a lot of interesting things going on there. And that's, I think that's a really interesting, maybe sociological or psychological study that folks could do.
Okay, and one last question that we have today is, how do you feel, I feel like you answered this a little bit in your presentation. How do you reconcile the effect? Zion was originally in order to support the poor, but the church's programs are now to build high-end development projects near temples. They're doing this in Philadelphia, City Creek, New Zealand. It seems like quite the opposite, actually, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Like that was one of the reasons why I called it the center point, because it's a shifting center point where it moves from being from each according to their ability to each according to their needs to really catering to the more wealthy individuals in the community and trying to solidify economic growth in those areas. But yeah, it's a real tension with the original way that the doctrines were laid out. And one of the things that I really am fascinated by is the shift from embracing these kinds of communes and cooperatives in the 1800s to a complete denial of any involvement with anything related to anything that looks socialist or communist during the Red Scare in the McCarthy era. And a lot of the quotes by people like Ezra Taft Benson, where they would absolutely deny any involvement with stuff like that, even though it's such an important part of our history and it's baked into the way that we designed our communities for half a century. Like there's a real tension there. And I don't think that that's really explored a lot because there's still a lot of discomfort among a lot of people in North America with the idea of communism and socialism and those kinds of trends and beliefs and ways of living.
Well, thank you so much for that presentation. And I think we're going to end it now. I would also like to see a little bit explored about how that affects with Mormon fundamentalist communities and the divide between them causing that divide as well between the rich and the poor. Because Mormon fundamentalist communities continue to share their food and things like that. We could talk about this all day, but I guess we got to go. So thank you so much, Graham Rutan from Alberta. Sharing all that with us, and I hope we can continue this discussion on the Whova app. I invite all of you to continue to submit questions. We can see if we can get them answered. And enjoy the rest of Sunstone. Bye-bye.
All right, everybody. Thank you.